climate topic really by my activist friends maybe about 8 or 9 years ago, who saw this thing they call the carbon market on the horizon already then. And they said, well, we don't really understand what's going on here, but we think we sense a danger in this. We sense a danger to people who were trying to defend their land against industrial tree plantations. You know, we sense a danger to all sorts of people trying to defend their forests and land rights in different contexts. We sense all sorts of dangers in this. And can you, Larry, spend some time looking into the tedious details of what this is actually going to be all about? And so, rather unwillingly, I was pushed into starting to try to understand what this market was about. And at first, I was concentrating mostly, as my colleagues were, on issues concerning land rights and tree plantations and what effect this carbon market would have on them. But quickly, the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized we were dealing with something even bigger than that. And that the carbon market, this mainstream solution, so-called solution to climate change, was actually posing some real problems for a lot of other movements as well. Movements against fossil fuel extraction in many different countries, anti-pollution movements, environmental justice movements. So I found myself with a little more on my plate than I had expected. And I won't say that's the reason that we tried to start the Durban Group, to spread the work around, but it certainly was necessary to form a global network to try to understand the impacts of this mainstream approach to global warming, which was, I guess, first enshrined in the Kyoto Protocol itself, and then later appeared in the EU emissions trading scheme, and is now surfacing again, rearing its ugly or pretty head, depending on how you look at it, in the Lieberman-Warner Act here in the U.S. So that's a little bit of my background. I guess I'd like to just ask maybe one or two of you where you come from, what your interest in the subject is, just to give me a feel of where we're going. Could you tell us?
Yes, my name's Bill. I'm with PROACT Microbial. We do manure treatment systems for big farms, dairy farms. And in our microbial process, we encourage the outgassing method. Mm-hmm. So we are producing some, and we're in the process of gathering. And what we run into out in the field is that there are companies out there who are financing, putting in full-fledged methane digesters for no money. Now they go in and put it in some of these farms, as long as it's big enough, and for nothing, all they want are the carbon credits. And so I've got to find out what's going on, because here I am out trying to sell stuff, and we got these guys out here giving it away. So they obviously know something that I don't know.
This actually reflects an interesting characteristic of this carbon market, is how difficult it is to get the whole picture of what's going on. I mean, there's so many technicalities involved with it, like these methane handlers that seems to be the end of the story, but actually it's connected to, as you suggest, a much larger picture. So we'll definitely get to that later today. How about you?
Well, I'm
Yes, you.
My name is Zara. I'm a senior here at Brown. I'm a friend of Julian, and I'm working, but I don't really know anything. And I've had conversations with Julian, brief ones, about climate change, and it really scares me. It's very, very scary. I just want to know more.
Okay, great. No,
okay.
I think you're a host, actually.
I am. I'm a host. I'm Steve Amber, I'm a professor here at the Center for Environmental Studies. And I suspect we're probably a little bit diverging in the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing carbon trading projects. I've been involved for the last 13 years. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the IPCC, and I was a lead author on the IPCC special report on land use change and forestry. Mm-hmm. I actually worked as the consultant to the UN Framework Convention Secretary.
couple more people, maybe. Everybody's studiously looking away. How about you? You're not looking away.
I'm Ardiana. I'm a first year here at Brown. And throughout high school, I did a lot of work with environmental science. And it's something that I have a lot of passion for. I just want to learn more. There's about 70 parts in the
city. Okay, great. One more person. How about you? You're looking away. Yes, you.
Senior of the conference here.
Okay, good. Okay, that gives me some idea. The title I've chosen today is When Solution Becomes Problem. And it shows up very well. And I try to, as the subtitle suggests, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about both the politics, the economics, and a bit of the science of this whole thing. Because one of the strange things about it is all of these things are very closely linked together. You know, the economic, this economic solution or this market approach to climate change has its own politics. And I would argue it also is in many ways driving the sort of technical work and the scientific work, even the theoretical work in climatology that's going on. So I want to try to relate all of these three things together, because if there's one area in which you really have to be interdisciplinary, it's this one. And of course, for that I'm specially qualified, because I actually have no technical competence in any of these fields whatsoever. So I'm free to say anything I like. I think Julian would like to make some remarks at the end about how to connect what we'll be talking about with some other things, including actions. So maybe I should try to aim at a discussion of, say, an hour and 15 minutes or so. And Julian, if you can remind me.
Sure.
If things are getting a little tight. I got too many slides. I got a lot of slides, so I'm going to go through some of them very fast. I'm going to probably skip a lot. But since I'm sort of here in the capacity of an ambassador from Europe, I mean, I'm American. I was born in Wisconsin, but I've actually been living in the UK for the last 15 years, and before that I was in Thailand for 10 years. So I have a little bit of perspective about what's happening outside the country in terms of these debates. So I suppose it's my duty to just to begin with some of the things that are being said, you know, in the headlines in Europe, not only in Europe, here as well, but mostly in Europe and around the world about this, you know, this strange new thing called the carbon market. So just to introduce, let me just quickly put up a few quotations. Okay, damning verdict on the EU's emissions trading scheme. The ETS, don't be afraid of these acronyms, this is just carbon trading. An emissions trading scheme, which has been going in Europe now for about 3 years, actually, has done nothing to curb emissions. Highly regressive tax falling mostly on poor people. Prices up, emissions up, profits up, so the policy goals have not been achieved. Big winners, hedge funds, energy traders. Losers, consumers. Not encouraged meaningful investment in carbon-reducing technologies. Coal plants, ironically, are being supported and subsidized through this market. Kyoto Protocol has failed. All through today, I'm going to be talking about, you know, the Kyoto Protocol and the EU emissions trading scheme and Lieberman, Warner, and God knows what all else. But the common thing about all these things is the centerpiece is carbon trading. Emissions trading and offset trading. These are basically collections of market or trading mechanisms. So, I might now and then refer to Kyoto, now and then refer to the EU emissions trading system, but we're talking about very similar kinds of political phenomena. Okay, truth about Kyoto, huge profits, little carbon saved, abuse and incompetence, it isn't working, grossly inefficient. Kyoto Market and the CDM are a risible disaster entirely of their own making. CDM can only be dismissed as a joke. As you can see, one of the interesting things about these quotations is they're coming not only from journalists and analysts, but actually from, and environmentalists, but actually from the business community as well. Carbon trading schemes could actually damage the environment. Campaigners say offsets have perverse effects, slow the changes needed to cope with global warming, actually contribute to global warming. International Herald Tribune. yes. Your parliamentarians over there on the other side of the pond tend to be a little bit more frank and blunt than your average very polite member of Congress here. So we get that. This is referring not to the EU emissions trading scheme, but to an experimental UK carbon trading scheme, which was started a bit earlier. Okay. Stifle discussion of alternative policy approaches, which is something I do want to stress later on. Let me just begin by how many of you have heard of cap and trade? Okay. How many have not heard of cap and trade? Okay, good. How many have heard the word carbon neutral? How many have not heard the word carbon neutral? Okay, one, two shy people. Okay, three. Good. Maybe there's more. Carbon offsets. How many have not heard the word carbon offset? Okay, good. Okay, so we have a bit of a varied audience here. So let's be patient with each other. I do want to go over these things just a little bit, but I'll be going very fast. So please, I like interruptions, and if you want to interrupt with an objection or question, please go ahead and do it. I'll go over this very briefly, but there are these two kinds of carbon trading. One of them is what they call cap and trade, and that's the same thing as what they call emissions trading. And the other kind is offset trading in carbon offsets, or sometimes they call it project-based credits. So this is all very confusing, but let's go slowly. I mean, the overall goal of carbon trading is an economic goal. It's to delay or to reduce corporate spending on modest numerical emissions cuts. That's worth spending a minute on, because it'll prepare the ground for what we can talk about later. This is very explicit. This is very explicit among the inventors and the originators of carbon trading. It's the main thing. It's an economic mechanism to reduce costs, especially costs to the private sector of making emissions cuts. But notice that the goal does have to do with emissions cuts. The purpose of the carbon trading was conceived around the objective of numerical emissions cuts. You know, we're going to cut 5%, we're going to cut 10%, or whatever. It was not actually conceived around the goal of addressing global warming. Well, you might say, well, what's the difference? You know, to deal with global warming, we have to make emissions cuts, and we've got to start somewhere, so let's start with, modest emissions cuts. I'd like to just raise a little question in your mind at the beginning to say that this maybe deserves a little bit more discussion. The goal of, cutting emissions by 5%, as cheaply as possible or whatever, the goal of cutting those emissions and the goal of addressing global warming might be two different things. I mean, global warming might actually be a more complicated problem than simply, making numerical emissions cuts. I just want to sort of plant that question at the beginning, because it'll be quite important later in talking about the scientific effectiveness of carbon trading. This sort of gives you the overall outline of what I want to say. I want to talk about both of these aspects of carbon trading, cap and trade, and offsets, and explain why I think and my colleagues think that they're both in trouble and that there are real questions about whether either one of them is fixable in any sense. Start with emissions trading. I guess most of you know what cap and trade is, what emissions trading is, but maybe just a brief illustration. I mean, the idea, emissions trading, I should have put cap and trade there up there because that's a more common expression, but cap and trade has two parts. The cap is set by the government for overall emissions of a society or of a sector, And that's a form of regulation. The government has to set an overall cap for the society. The trading part is supposed to save you money in achieving that cut. And it works something like, well, suppose it's very expensive for me to cut my emissions. Like, for example, I'm a power generator, I'm committed to coal, I've got billions of dollars in coal plant. Or suppose I'm in the iron and steel or oil and gas industry, I can't make cuts. It's very difficult for me to make cuts except marginal ones, minor cuts. So if the government says, well, okay, you have to cut, it's going to be very difficult for me to do that. So what I want is some way to do that more cheaply. Well, suppose you instead are a firm for whom cuts are actually very easy and not expensive. You're not committed to fossil fuels, for example. You're not committed to these sort of greenhouse gas intensive technologies. And you're very innovative, and you can think of ways of cutting your emissions a lot. So it's cheap for you to do it. Well, the logic is, why don't I pay you to make my cuts for me? We trade emissions cuts. So I pay you to cut more than the government requires you to cut. You have to cut your own emissions, but you cut extra and you sell the extra cuts to me. You make money because I'm paying you, and I save money because I use those emissions cuts, or a better word would be pollution rights. I use the pollution rights that you sell to me so that I can continue business as usual. I can continue to pollute. The overall cap doesn't change. The governmental goal is still the same, but you're making the cuts and I'm paying you to make the cuts. So it's cheaper. We both make out. I save money, you make money. That's the basic idea of emissions trading. Offset trading is different, but we'll get to that later. I just want to go quickly over a few of the difficulties that my colleagues around the world and I have identified with emissions trading, and think carefully about what it means for climate politics. One of the problems is measurement, how to measure and how to enforce it. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about this carbon trading is this is an entirely new market, basically created by economists, created out of the economics classroom, the neoclassical economics classroom, in alliance with NGOs, with government officials. It's a market which has actually been created sort of, out of very little precedent, out of nothing. You've had to create a whole new commodity, which has never been a commodity before. And so you suddenly have to become aware that all of these things about markets that we take for granted are actually very difficult to do. For example, to have a market, you've got to measure. You've got to know how much of what you're selling, how much of the commodity you're selling. And if you're a buyer, you have to know how much you're buying. Otherwise, you can't have a market. I mean, that's one of the really important sort of prerequisites of a market we take for granted, because we don't have any problem with measuring most commodities. You just put them on the scale, or measure them, in some other way, or you have some kind of regulation which measures them. But we're creating a new commodity here, so we have to think of these basic things. How do we measure it? How do we measure this? Property rights, the third thing, is another thing we sort of take for granted with markets. Well, if you're selling something, of course you have to own it, and if you buy it, the ownership is transferred to you. We take this for granted. Well, of course, it's obvious. But because we're creating a market out of a completely new commodity, where previously no one has ever had any property rights. We're actually talking about a very mysterious thing out there, which includes the oceans, that includes the atmosphere, it includes trees, grass, soil, rocks. We're talking about the carbon cycling capacity, or the carbon absorbing capacity, of this entire sort of geological, biological, atmospheric system. And nobody actually has property rights over that carbon cycling capacity. No one had ever thought about it before. But suddenly, if we have to create a market in this, we have to buy and sell this capacity, we have to create property rights. And that makes us think, well, creating property rights is actually a really difficult thing. I mean, we take it for granted, especially in the U.S., private property systems are very well established, there's a legal basis, everybody knows who owns what, if you trespass on somebody's land, you're going to get shot at, all of this sort of stuff. It's taken for granted. But, this market makes us think about history and think about how these things got started, even with, the United States and its private property system. They weren't natural, they didn't come out of nowhere. You know, for example, in the 18th and 19th century, and actually long before, there was this thing called the enclosure movement. Anyone heard of the enclosure movement in Europe? Okay, there were these things called commons, which were community, basically a form of community property, not necessarily, usually not sellable, buyable. They were a different form of property. But, you know, during the enclosure movements in Europe, and actually there are quite a few enclosure movements, many different kinds, a lot of land was basically taken over and privatized and transformed into a form of private property from something that wasn't private property before. I'm not saying that's exactly the same thing that's happening here with climate, but when we think about a new market, we should think about how markets have been created in the past. And we should think about things like the enclosure movement in Europe, because this is not only economically important, it's also politically important. As everybody knows who studied the enclosure movements in Europe, you know, this was a very wrenching political process as well as an economic process. It wasn't just that, you know, you handed out title deeds to all of this land that used to be common land and everybody got on with buying and selling and everybody was happy. No. Actually changing this property into private property had profound political effects. It had a lot of repressive effects. A lot of people were driven off the land. A lot of people, you know, had to move to cities. A lot of people were deprived of their livelihoods. And this also makes us think about politics today, because this sort of process is actually happening, continues to happen in the U.S. as well today, 2007. But it, you know, is also happening all over the world in many different ways, including the seizure of land, the privatization of commons land. You know, this is happening throughout Asia. It happens throughout Latin America and Africa as well. And it's happening now. It's also still happening in Europe in various ways. And, you know, new things are being privatized all the time. So I'm just emphasizing this to say that, you know, it's useful when we talk about the climate problem to think about history and to think about politics at the same time. Innovation is another thing, I think, which is a real problem for carbon trading to deal with, because innovation, I think, as I try to argue, is central to dealing with the climate crisis. And it interferes with existing positive approaches. Emissions trading, sort of gone over that. Measurement, but just very briefly on measurement, you know, people jump on the idea of trading emissions or cap and trade. It sounded simple in the U.S. context, but, you know, as I said, it's more difficult than it looks, because you have to start with the basics, like how do you measure this stuff? And even, you know, even measuring the stuff coming out of smokestacks turns out to be a lot more difficult than you thought. Even in the U.S., even in industrialized countries. There's some interesting new research I just heard about the other week coming out of Sweden, in one of the most advanced, supposedly advanced technological countries, which suggests that actually even Sweden is not doing the measurements that are required to show that it's complying with the EU emissions trading system. And if it's not doing those measurements, then nobody knows actually what's being bought and sold, even in Sweden. So there are these problems with measurement and enforcement, even in, you know, industrialized countries. Then there's the question that my colleague Ruth Greenspan Bell at Resources for the Future in Washington has called our attention to in quite a few recent articles, where she just said, well, okay, but let's talk about other countries as well, where, you know, the technology is not available to do these complicated measurements. The political culture is different, the enforcement culture is different. It's not going to be easy to impose this, you know, on an international scale. In the U.S., of course, we had this thing called sulfur dioxide trading. How many of you sort of have heard of that? Okay, that's good. This is the thing actually that the Kyoto Protocol and a lot of other carbon trading systems modeled on was this SO2 trading system, which was supposed to deal with the acid rain problem, or make dealing with the acid rain problem cheaper than it would have been starting in the 1990s. And everybody says, well, it worked with sulfur dioxide, so, gosh, it should work with global warming. Well, no. It does not follow. There are a lot of differences between the sulfur dioxide problem and the global warming problem, and one of them is technology. Sulfur dioxide is a single substance, not all that many sources. these new technologies which could measure them sort of continuously in real time and beam the results to a central location became available and made the law possible, which brought about trading. Without that technology, the trading in sulfur dioxide would have been meaningless, would have been counterproductive. The question is, do we have those sorts of technologies when we're dealing with emissions of greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide? We should remember the problem is very different. There are a lot more sources. The whole system of producing carbon dioxide is much more complex. I mean, there's so many different kinds of sources, so many more sources. There are sinks soaking it up, all these sorts of things. That's one of the differences. Another one of the differences, the sulfur dioxide trading system was aimed at achieving a modest numerical goal. Again, the global warming problem is a little different, as I'm going to try to argue. The global warming problem actually requires a little bit more thoroughgoing approach. In fact, it requires rethinking how we deal with energy, how we deal with transport, how we deal with the way our communities are organized. It's something that suggests to me, at least, that structural social change and sweeping structural technological change is going to be necessary. And that's a little different from the goal of just achieving some modest, numerical cut in emissions. Second problem, I'll talk about innovation, and this sort of begins to elaborate what I was just saying about the nature of the global warming problem. And one thing that governments are starting to really agree on with respect to the global warming problem is that structural reinvestment, structural change has to begin now if it's not to produce a lot of problems later. It'll be more expensive if we put it off even 5 years. It'll be more dangerous to us and maybe even to our survival if we put it off 5 or 10 years. Structural change has to begin now. The governments themselves are telling us this now. Well, how does carbon trading, how does emissions trading, cap and trade, deal with that? One of the interesting things about cap and trade is that it does provide incentive for certain kinds of change. It provides incentive for the innovator, the person who's not structurally wedded, locked into fossil fuels, to change. But at the same time, it provides a disincentive for the immediate start to structural change that the governments are all telling us is necessary. How does that work? I mean, suppose I'm a coal-fired generator. I've invested billions of dollars in capital plant suited to coal. I'm not going to just, if the price of carbon appears and goes up, I'm not just suddenly going to be able to switch to windmills or switch to solar. It's not that easy. I've got a 30-year investment horizon, maybe a 40-year investment horizon. I've got to have incentives which will, force me to start taking action now, which will lead to really sweeping structural change. And it's interesting that emissions trading actually disincentivizes that. How does it do that? Because I can buy credits from you, the people who were not wedded to fossil fuels. I can put off the change I need by buying carbon permits, pollution rights from other people for whom these changes are cheap. So I can put it off 5 years, 10 years. Even if the price is high, I mean, how do I know what the price is going to be in 30 years? There's some real problems here about whether the emissions trading actually fits the specific nature of the global warming problem, which is different from your average sort of sulfur dioxide pollution reduction problem. And just to sort of reinforce that, and maybe just return to basics for just a second. I mean, the global warming problem is complex, but I think everybody agrees the real core of the problem is this black stuff, and in particular, the way that this black stuff is coming out of the place that it's locked underground and into the atmosphere, and into the oceans, and into the rocks and soil and trees and all that stuff. But the upshot is that it tends to accumulate in the... You like those pictures? It took me a long time to draw them. But the upshot is that it accumulates in the atmosphere. And Tim Planner is a biologist from Australia, and he puts it, there's so much carbon buried in the world, coal seems alone that should it find its way back to the surface, it would make the planet hostile to life as we know it. I mean, what that suggests, and this gives you some idea of the size of the carbon pools involved. What that suggests is that actually it's simply a fact that we're going to have to keep most remaining coal in the ground. It is not ever going to be mined. It is going to stay in the ground. And I think that's true to a large extent of oil as well. That's just a fact we have to live with. It's going to stay there. It has to stay there.